This is SaaS Scaled, the podcast where data meets action with host Armon Shrocky. Each week, Armon will be sitting down with CEOs and industry leaders from the technology sector, giving you the insight to innovate without reinventing the wheel. They'll discuss challenges, best practices, and how to identify the right metrics. So if you want to get to market faster and in a way that matters, then subscribe and join us every week as we discuss SaaS Scale. This episode is brought to you by Curvey, the modern no-code analytics solution, the tools you need to take action with your data on a platform built for maximum scalability, security, and cost efficiencies. If you're ready to reduce complexity and dramatically lower costs, then contact us today at curvey.com. That's Q-R-V-E-Y.com.
Hello, welcome to another episode of SaaS Scaled. I'm pleased to have a great guest this time, and Maren Martin is joining me. I would ask her to please introduce herself and tell us a little bit about herself and the company as well. We are going to have a fantastic discussion.
So yes, it's a great pleasure to be here. I'm very thrilled about our discussion. The topic is one near and dear to my heart. I am Marnie Martin, the CEO of Emburse. We're the independent leader in travel and expense management. Expense management is more than reimbursements. It's also everything that you do to consolidate your procure tech through to payment. So really thinking that through. We're a leader in adoption of AI as well as the fintech that we're growing. So a really exciting space. We compete at the large end against Concur and, of course, at the smaller end with customers against Ramp for two businesses that viewers might know.
Fantastic. I appreciate that brief introduction. So I have been using some of those systems as well in the past, and I know that there are a lot of complexity, even if it doesn't really... It has to be simple for users, of course, to use it, but there are a lot of complexity behind the scene when you use some of these services, especially for companies that have presence in different locations, even different states in the United States, and more complexity when they have presence outside and internationally, how to manage those. So this is definitely a complex system running in the back, on the back office, running very kind of smoothly everything. And from your perspective, being in charge of this business with this kind of complex software, but also a lot of companies that are using it, what is the biggest challenge that you see in order to really, when you did scale the company and manage the company, what was your biggest challenge? It was on the technology side, it was on the business side, it was building the kind of the sales and marketing team, or making the product the way market wants, or a mixture of both, and it changed from time to time.
So let me give you a quick short history. So I actually grew up on cattle ranches, economics, finance, statistics, Georgetown, Lund School of Economics, and I did a couple majors. Never did a PhD in behavioral economics, but I still think that's relevant today to understand. When SaaS software started, you, of course, had a ton of on-premise software as well in 1996 when I started my full-time career. And I started working internationally already in 1997. Personally, I've been in 70 different countries. I've been running global go-to-market in more than 100 countries. My first leadership job was in 27, before you had what I would call a software operator role. We did some of the first PE investing in technology, early stage software. I ran public companies for a while, and then now I run primarily private equity software companies, SaaS, but you will occasionally have some still conversion from on-premise to SaaS. One of the unique things about me is because of the international scope from the beginning of my career, I always had a blended portfolio of software. So I was innovating from the very beginning, and we also brought in some of the first AI solutions. Back in the 90s, you had workforce management, asset management, some defense applications, telco applications, primarily in the enterprise space. And you had almost no AI and what I'd call true SaaS for SMB back then. So in the decades that came, AI, of course, artificial intelligence, of course, has evolved, and generative AI is the latest and greatest. But so has what it means to be the software industry. And it's obviously became a huge industry. And here we're talking about specifically software as a service. What's interesting is in my 20s, I had two businesses, technology businesses. One was a technology business. The other was a life sciences business, that I took it from doing the first spreadsheet to $1 billion of enterprise value and $2.5 billion enterprise value, respectively. One we sold to a strategic, the other we went public. At that point, it became very apparent to me, and this really has been a source of my success through my entire career, is it's the combination of financial acumen, like how do you finance and grow companies, ideally with profitable growth, but if you do have periods of unprofitability, how do you finance them in capital rounds that aren't too dilutive to get to an exit generally? The second and the third are frankly the most relevant to your question, is how do you drive go-to-market leadership alongside technology leadership? And I'll tell you, I learned a huge amount prior to the dot-com crisis that it's not always the best technology that survives or wins. You have to have technology that customers want to buy. Therefore, you can have a successful go-to-market and scaling strategy. So that really continued to hone the intersection of those three things. I like triangles. So you need to have the financial acumen to scale companies, but you definitely need to have the go-to-market alongside the technology or product leadership to understand how you can scale. And you have to make sure also that, you know, when you care about innovation, that is rewarding, right? As a founder or an entrepreneur or someone who's an innovator, right? But that has to be into a go-to-market to scale, right? You see a lot of founders and entrepreneurs that are good on the innovation side, but they're not good at the scaling and the go-to-market side. And to really scale a profitable business, you have to be thinking about what is a famous book now, I think in its third generation, Crossing the Chasm. Mm-hmm. Do you have a mature enough market that you can scale to the level you want to scale? That may be 10 million ARR, 20 million, 100 million, a billion ARR, like whatever the level of scaling is you're looking for. Do you have a mature enough market, a big enough TAM, and can you execute on that while maintaining technology leadership, the product market fit, all those good things?
Yeah, that's very true. When you say the phase of the company and also the relationship of that phase with whatever differentiates the company, if it's innovation that differentiates it, or if it is really the ability to scale, right? So if a scalability at the probably higher revenue number is what can really differentiate that business, the way it's designed, the way it's built, and it can scale while some other businesses maybe have reached to that point, but they have built the business in a way that they don't have that solid foundation that helps them to really scale. Now, innovation, does it help to differentiate and scale or not? That's the question.
Well, I think to drive differentiation at scale, you need to also start putting in a renewals motion and have sufficient stickiness. I mean, this is mm-hmm. why we've seen over the last 30 years, highly exciting businesses that didn't stay sticky. And this really comes back to something I learned in my economic days, that you need to have a competitive advantage, right? At first, when we study that in economics, you're thinking more about trade patterns and things like that. But it still applies to software. And what's interesting in this era of AI and where we're going now it's even harder to have competitive advantage if you don't have sufficient scale and stickiness, because generative AI and the tools that we have available now, you know, it's even faster than kind of how we used to measure innovation based on CPU capacity, right? Yes, we still care about, you know, computing capacity. That won't change. And I think that over time, AI models, we've built a purpose-built AI model that's super cloud efficient. I think the ones that aren't, you'll start to see them fade away because they won't be economic to run, et cetera. But you have to be having the data and enough competitive advantage to be able to not just scale in the first place, but also to stay relevant and have a sustainable business. Like, we talk about sustainability related to the environment, which of course is important, but I always think about sustainability in the sense of stickiness and is this a business that can last? I've always tried to pick software businesses to run that had problems to solve, had outcomes to deliver, but were also software businesses that wouldn't go away through automation. They'd be enhanced by automation and AI, but you would still need them in 5, 10, 20 years. Because there's other types of businesses that I think will become obsolete because we will be able to take conventional paper or conventional processes that are even in place today and do away with them over the next 5 to 10 years in this next wave of SaaS reinvention.
Yep, very true. Yep. Now, you mentioned the point that with Gen AI and all of these technologies that are accelerating the pace of, you know, building things, generating result, it might be harder to actually, you know, find a competitive edge for some companies. Having said that, from another aspect, we see in the market that a still customer base is that, I would say, number one parameter that allows company to really, if they bring the right technology and they have the customer base, they can really generate a better result, whether comparison with a AI first company that started from AI with no legacy system, and they have maybe the technology with no legacy system, but they don't have any customer base and they just wanted to build the customer base. If I had to choose between these two, I would personally choose the customer base, established customer base, but the company now can bring the AI technologies to improve what they do and then step by step go forward and bring the value of AI to their customers as well. Now, I wonder...
Let me pause on that. So one, I agree with you. I think customers are still what buy, okay? You can't have... This was my point about what I learned even before the dot-com crisis. You can have, frankly, an amazing idea. I thought quantum computing brought you back in the, you know... Mm-hmm. early 2000s would change the world. We're still trying to figure it out. Okay? Same with vision, right? So there are things that will eventually change the world, but it's not ready for customers to adopt at a sufficient level, right? This is what crossing the chasm is about, getting to more mature sectors. It's something that Salesforce proved out very well with CRM as a category separate from ERP, blah, blah, blah. What differentiates, in my opinion, the winners and losers, or what will differentiate them over the next 5 to 10 years, is brand recognition tied with customer loyalty. Do customers trust them? Do they want to stay with that software vendor? Then the question is that software vendor that has the brand awareness and the customer loyalty able to innovate? Does it have the right talent and people? Not just the CEOs and C-level, but do you have those people in middle management, in individual contributor roles that can really drive continuous innovation at pace? They can't wait 3 years for a new innovation anymore. We're talking about how you innovate each month, right? Which is suitable to SaaS, but we're not talking about kind of a SaaS continuous release motion anymore. We're talking about a continuous innovation motion. And to do that, you have to have the customer loyalty to start, but you also have to have the data underpinnings, the databases, the data structures that enable you to put AI on top of them in secure ways with the domain-specific models and use cases. And then you can start building many, many products on top of it. You know, there was a recent announcement that Salesforce was going to stop Glean being able to look at Slack messages. We're doing similar things ourselves in Emberse, that we hold our customers' data very safely and securely. We have a foundational layer now of Emberse AI. And then we've come out with this concept of Emberse Intelligence, that we can keep the data inside Emberse and start putting a lot of other products on top of it, not just agentic AI products, but products that'll look at how you do taxes more efficiently off of expense data, how you actually not just do AP automation, but think about, are you actually buying from the best vendor? How should you think about treasury management in expense, payments, like all these sorts of things? So customer first, that continues. I do think the companies have to have and prize even more AI leadership and knowledge within all ranks of their employees, including the C-suite and the board. And then those companies that have the data structures that they can put proprietary AI on top of, versus having to go contract with an OpenAI or Google or, you know, you name it, those will be also the companies that can scale the most efficiently with the best gross margins and also the closest alignment with their customers, building on the customer trust they already have.
Yeah, and yep. You touched on the surface of so many great concepts that always will be true about business, like you need to have a strong brand and maintain it, and, you know, trust is a big deal there. So your customers need to trust you and your brand. And that's one of the best tools that any business has in order to scale. You touched on the surface of, for example, the business needs to be aware of what market needs and move faster and respond to the market needs in a quarterly basis. Not every 3 years we come up with something that addresses the market. Market is moving faster now. So you need to be more aware of that and you need to move faster. A lot of these, and you also mentioned about the quality of data, that if your data is not quality data, you may not be able to build the products on top of it that definitely results, you know, what you want. So the data quality is something that helps organizations to really have the kind of the right products on top of it. And of course, AI is one of them. So as I hear you, it's like 90% of everything that we could hear 10 years ago is still there, but with some exceptions that technology is now enabling you faster. So you just need to really, you know, do the same things, but you can now, and you should as a business do things a little bit kind of better, faster, and you can probably do it less expensively as well.
True, but I think there's, so 100% agreement. I think there's two things to mention alongside that that are really critical for everyone to think about. They're things that I've always thought about, but the pace now is even more important. So I run at a fast pace. I talk about thinking about and driving invention and reinvention and consideration of all these things on a daily basis. I've done that all my life. But how you build organizations that can work that way while scaling bigger and bigger and handling global complexity, there's a lot of tuning and retooling that will need to happen in businesses that are already at a certain scale. One of the things that I've talked a lot about in our company is how we build out, you know, three things: market leadership, profitable growth, and a great place to work. Alongside the great place to work is we are paying even more attention to the people that can work efficiently, but fast. Okay. And you do have a lot more tools now to enable that. You know, when you had to manually with people tag machine learning data, that could take a year manually when we can do it in 2 days now with Gen AI tools, right? So there are a lot of advantages and tools, but we have to make sure that we have the people that can run at that pace. I laugh that, you know, when I'm talking to people, I'm like, I need in tech or in STEM, the Usain Bolts and the Michael Phelps and, you know, all the female athletes like that who are, you know, at the top of the game and can run at pace. You also then need a go-to-market that can operate at that pace. And I'll say this is putting even more demand on our pre-sales and our sales organizations to be able to take enablement material, learn it, articulate it at a faster pace than they've ever had to before, right? So when you talk about pace, it's not just changing from a product side, it's changing everything that you do, the type of people you'll need to still be relevant in 5 years, how we're thinking about go-to-market, also how we're starting to evolve sales-led versus product-led go-to-market. You can target buyers now with propensity to buy, different messages. You know, Facebook is, of course, doing this in their segment, but you'll see more of that coming into B2B software marketing, even changing whether you need SDRs, BDRs anymore. So, you know, this reinvention goes across everything that you do. And it's really, I think, going to be also a time of danger for a lot of the really large ERPs or even CRM companies that if you look out the next 10 to 20 years, will they have the people, the structures, the processes to pivot? Because other companies will be getting to at least $1 billion of revenue and then seeing where they go from there. You know, so this is what keeps me working. It really keeps me excited. And I think it'll be a fascinating time in software. On the last point related to monetization of this at scale, I think that's where, you know, a company like us, we're doing some what I'd call conventional SaaS monetization, but we're also starting to test what people are loosely calling hybrid monetization around AI, things like that. So for us, it's incremental to how we grow, and it's a great source of growth, profitable growth. But, you know, if you think about the businesses that are primarily on-premise today, or they have, you know, $20 billion of conventional SaaS ARR, you know, it's going to be interesting how disruptive that's going to be to their public listings and how they think about it. Because, you know, if they have to move from a primarily subscription ARR to more of an AI consumption usage database, you know, whatever ends up coming out as the standard 5 years from now, then you might actually see some of these big companies contracting versus growing.
Yeah, very, very good point. Because monetization and innovation in monetization in particular can be probably one of the most impactful innovations for the business that normally is overlooked, because we pay attention a lot to innovating on the technology side, innovating on the business side, innovating even on the process side, versus really thinking about how did really our packaging, pricing, monetization kind of policies and everything that we have. And AI definitely is going to introduce new avenues for companies to really rethink about how to monetize it. And I would say, as a person that is working with many SaaS companies that are utilizing AI, still have not figured that out, that how to monetize it. They know probably as we talk every week, every month, every quarter, they're getting more ideas around what the real use cases are that bring real value, but the next stage is how to monetize it, right? And how to really bring this AI.
Yeah, 100% right. So I've been selling AI-powered software now for more than 10 years as the primary, okay? Mm-hmm. So I'll say that you obviously can sell off of a transactional model, an outcomes-based model. Mm-hmm. You know, I've done that. But then the question is, how much do people and change management in the companies you're selling to either increase the outcome or decrease the outcome, right? This is where I think the ability of especially the largest of the multinationals to actually adopt AI-based workflows is also a bit of a risk if we as vendors are going to think about only outcome-based pricing or a gain share or some sort of productivity. So I've made sure that I have stayed in software that had a very strong outcomes correlation that we could prove and validate and work towards. But I still think you're going to end up with some sort of a license fee, some sort of a subscription, a platform fee, whatever you think about that kind of gives entitlement rights. And then I think on top of that, we'll have some sort of outcomes and productivity type aspect, at least for the next 5 years. What I don't know yet, and I'll deal with thinking about this probably in the next 2 to 3 years, is what happens when agentic AI has become more ubiquitous, right? You're seeing more and more open source agentic AI solutions are coming faster than I've ever seen in my life, right? And those are free to use. So when they become somewhat commoditized, right, you can have an argument whether OpenAI will become commoditized. I don't know. That's not the discussion today. But you know, you're going to see the risk of commoditization of some of the new Gen AI and agentic AI. And then the question will be, all right, in say 2030 to 2040, how are we going to be driving the next wave of outcomes and productivity? Because anyone that signs a 5-year SaaS contract this year, that'll be up for renewal in 2030. And then how are we going to think about monetization? What's the next in terms of outcomes or productivity then?
There are many software applications, software products, software as a service products out there in the market. If you think about them, some of them might be more intelligent than the others. And, you know, in general, we are getting into the intelligence age. You hear even sometimes they sell, hey, we are going to create this huge number of computers connected to each other, and we are going to provide intelligence as a service, right? So even OpenAI is thinking about marketing intelligence as a service now, and rather than selling really, or even, you know, hardware companies like NVIDIA may get into that business, that we are going to really sell intelligence as a service. Now, software applications also can get smarter as a result, meaning that different software applications can really increase the intelligence. So at the point that you look at the market and you can see this software product is more intelligent than the other software product, and that may become another competitive edge. That, of course, as you said, it's not just about the product getting more intelligence. You have to have the execution power in the company to execute the plan well. You have to have the right people to really support. There are tons of things around it. So I'm not saying that only if you have the more intelligent product or technology that wins. It needs to be supported by all of those foundation that you just mentioned, like people, like processes, the organization behind it, all of the great execution, everything. But at the end of the day, what people see from outside is, I'm using this service and it's more intelligent. So we are going to see, do you see such a future that people from outside look at these products and say, this is getting more intelligent at the, you know, pace that it was not happening maybe 10 years ago, and products are just getting more intelligent?
Yes, 100%. And I think they're getting more intelligent in all categories of SaaS software. So both SMB through the largest of enterprise and multinationals. You know, in fact, we've rolled out Emberse AI across our customer base, both more active development products, as well as some of the historical products that we had acquired. Our team did a great job. But in addition to AI and what we've rolled out and what we continue to build on, we also have started talking about this concept of expense intelligence. Again, we're focusing on how we have expense intelligence become as important as CRM has become, right? Because managing your expenses is a huge part of determining your profitability, not just managing your customer revenue. And that concept of expense intelligence blends what will be the next era of reimagined software. You know, right now people are putting more intelligence, more artificial intelligence, as well as extracting more human intelligence into the software workflows. The next layer of that, once you get beyond kind of the automation and reimagining software in that context and getting our B2B customers used to using software in that context, we'll be thinking about, what do you really need software for anymore? You already see, granted, it's come at a huge cost. OpenAI is not a profitable business, but what they have accomplished in putting intelligence on the mobile phone, if you have a ChatGPT app or whatever, is pretty amazing, right? And we have to make sure that we're continuing to drive that access to data in a way for our customers that continues to advance their workflows, their strategic capabilities, in our case, catering to Office of the CFO and finance departments, but in ways that actually are more secure and also tie in with data residency. Because I think that you're going to see the businesses succeed like Emburse that are good at this, that have the people focused on it. But again, it's going to require also very strong attention to security, trust, data integrity, data privacy. Because I think over and over, there's going to be more and more resistance to people giving the data to these large commercial AI models. And you're going to see, and I think Gartner and others agree with me, you're going to see more and more tailored or domain-specific models used in software matching to the use cases. And then again, we'll still have the fun things, hopefully, as users and consumers of technology to type in our general queries. But you're going to see more and more tailoring into the use cases. And that's even how we're using AI solutions in every department of Emburse. You know, we're selling it to our customers, but we're also heavy users, heavy testers. We do bake-offs of different AI solutions, even within our own department. So that actually gives us a huge amount of intelligence of what's going on in categories of software that we're using. And I think that I haven't found any other CEO in the peer group or even the larger companies that is paying as much attention to how they use AI as how they sell AI. And I also, you know, whenever we buy an AI product, I also survey how they're charging us, whether we like it, whether we don't like it, are we getting outcomes from it? You know, and that also evolves how we're thinking about driving monetization ourselves to our customers.
Do you think, in addition to humans and users using your software and services at the moment, you will see increasingly digital workers and users, meaning AI agents, start using, and they are actually become at one point maybe the majority of users using the services that you provide?
So I think will it be used much more? 100% right. I think the question will be how all this evolves. I was one of the early adopters and actually early acquirers of a lot of cool AI solutions over the years. In fact, there was this product we had a few companies before that was based for telco contact centers, and it actually was quite a good AI, we called it chatbots back in the day, but it was really a game changer and very, very, very much superior as a product related to the AI algorithms that they had, et cetera, et cetera. The problem that we had was it took so much compute power to make it work. And a lot of the data that we were trying to get the knowledge out of for the AI agent to work wasn't accessible. That was back in the early 2010s. I think now we have a lot more structured, accessible data. We know how to go create and train models. This is really kind of the large language model or small language model evolution that then enabled Gen AI and agentic AI to get good. Because I think now there's plenty of very good agents. Okay, they've come a long way from even 2013. But if the data isn't good for the agents to work off of, you know, you have much better technology for natural language processes, understanding accents and inquiries and queries than we ever did before. That's intelligence all in its own in the category of agentic AI. So the agents now are better at understanding what a human is asking and also what a human wants from them. And we are better at giving them the data that enables them to return answers promptly with accuracy, right? So all of this has to fit together. How much becomes agents of agents? How much we get what we used to call deep learning, self-learning? I think that'll, you can make users pretend or think they're getting deep learning or self-learning just because you have higher quality of data and you're putting together the data in ways that an agent can return to them vis-a-vis agentic AI. I don't really call that deeper self-learning because you're just making a better job of matching the data to the query to the agent. But I do think you will see rapid evolution of all this in the next 5 years. And then we'll start seeing how much do people want to interact with people? How much have they all adapted to interacting with agents because it's more efficient? And then we'll kind of see how all this is landing and where we actually end up. And then we'll see then, you know, what is innovation in the decade 2030 to 2040. So that'll be an interesting topic for then. But definitely the next 5 years, we're going to see a lot of adoption of agentic AI. We'll see agents on agents. And we'll see in the end where people still want to use their human intelligence to learn content themselves versus just asking an agent, an AI agent.
Yeah, no, I appreciate your comprehensive answer. It was wonderful because you looked at it from all aspects, and that gives us a very good kind of understanding of, you know, just a 360-degree view rather than just looking at it from one single angle. So as the last question, I would like to ask you if there is any book that has been impactful and you loved it and you like to share with the audience.
So I love reading and I actually read very fast. People ask me like, how did you respond so fast? I'm like, well, I read your message really fast. So that's funny. So if people ask me, do I have a favorite book, that changes all the time. But one book that I actually loved so much when it came out, I agreed to write a foreword for it. And I still love it today. And I think it's highly relevant for anyone that wants to lead or think through this next 5 years of where we're going, is Faisal Hoki's book called Reinvent. And it really talks about the people, the organization, the monetization, the mind shift, the technology, the product aspects of how you reinvent in a digital age. So even since that book has been written, we have a lot more AI tools and all sorts of things. The pace is amazing. But the principles and the mindset and everything that's in that book about how you reinvent in the digital age is very, very relevant. I highly recommend it to anyone that cares about SaaS and where we are today, as well as cares about being relevant as a leader, not just a manager, but a leader in this area over the next 5, 10, 20 years.
Thank you so much. Great discussion. I personally enjoyed it and learned quite a bit. So I hope everyone enjoyed it too. And thank you again for joining us, Marty.
Thank you for listening to SaaS Scaled with Armon Ashraghi. For show notes and any resources mentioned in today's episode, go to saasscaled.com. If you're enjoying our show, give us a 5-star review and share on LinkedIn. And be sure to subscribe for any updates on future episodes. Thanks for listening. This episode is brought to you by Curve, the modern no-code analytics solution, the tools you need to take action with your data on a platform built for maximum scalability, security, and cost efficiencies. If you're ready to reduce complexity and dramatically lower costs, then contact us today at curve.com. That's Q-R-V-E-Y.com.